on Ways and Means for March 9th, 2005. Open the hearing for SB 5513. We have a very full agenda today. I want to thank Senator Gordley for taking my place yesterday. And that actually brings the Senate down to maybe about half. About half have been ill so far, so you've got a long way to catch up. So we will start off, I believe, the first party on the agenda. There is a group of two, and did you want to introduce them?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, George Pernsteiner, Acting Chancellor of the University System, and if with the Chair's indulgence, I'll address a few questions that came up yesterday.
Okay.
So that we can sort of close the loop on the issues that were raised yesterday. You have in your packets a letter addressed to Senator Devlin from Nancy Heiligman, the Assistant Chancellor for Budget and Financial Policy, which addresses some of those issues. I'll go very briefly through them. The first dealt with a request to provide information about enrollment degree offerings at Southwest Oregon University Center. There are 24 bachelor's and 8 graduate degrees that are offered there. Eastern Oregon University, of course, manages the that center, but is participated in with Oregon State, Southern Oregon, OHSU, Western, Portland State, and Linfield. And there are about 236 students at that center right now. The second dealt with those community colleges which do not yet have dual enrollment arrangements with Oregon University System schools. At the moment, there are three, but two of those are in process of developing such agreements right now. The only one that is not is Clatsop Community College, but just yesterday the president of Clatsop approached me by email, and so my hope is that we can eliminate the entire list as soon as possible. The third dealt with some differences in the enrollment at the Cascades campus. We reported 438 students. That is the number that is associated with the offerings of Oregon State University, and it's an Oregon State branch campus. However, there are another 126 students who are at that center, at the branch campus, who are students of OHSU, Linfield, Concordia, U of O, or Eastern. They do not count in that 438. They're in addition. And then there's 133 students from Central Oregon Community College who are in a dual enrollment program. The services provided by the OSU branch campus deal with admissions and financial aid and a variety of advising, but they do not deal with direct instruction. Those students show up on the COCC roster. So the total is 697, very close to the number that Representative Wisnant thought it should be if we counted all those different kinds of students. Those were the questions that came from the committee. There's also a few things in the letter that are, gee, I wish I'd said that, kinds of comments. The first deals with the Oregon Institute of Technology. There was a question raised about the faculty salaries at OIT and why they seem to be above the median for comparator institutions. The problem with OIT is there are very few real comparators, and most of those that we use really don't have the program mix OIT does. I think the more pertinent point is that a BS graduate from OIT last year made about $45,000 coming out of school. An assistant professor that we hired at OIT made about $43,000. So I think that's perhaps for OIT a more telling point on faculty salaries than that ranking was. We have included also an attachment on cultural competence that we have provided to the Oregon Department of Education, and some statistics on distance education that were requested. We would note that we have grown from 2,100 students in distance ed programs 10 years ago to more than 35,000 students today with 34 degrees offered. And there's also a fuller explanation of the work of the joint boards that's listed with all of the priorities that they have as opposed to just the ones that Kirby Dias and I can remember. So those are the questions from yesterday, and I hope that this attachment addresses fully those questions. And with that, unless there are further questions about the questions, I'd like to preview day two. Day two, I think, is going to be the most interesting and exciting day of the six that we have. And the reason is that in day two, you get to spend some time with our faculty and our students. There's a whole variety of students who have made the trek, some of them from as far away as LeGrand, to be here. And we have also two of our Sterling faculty who are representative of many of the faculty whom we have at the seven universities. We also are joined today by four of our board members, and I think they will provide for you the framework of access, affordability, excellence, and economic development, which surrounds the whole budget message which we're bringing to you this session, and which surrounds the kinds of work that is being done by the faculty and the students. So without any more of my babbling, I'd like to introduce Jerry Richmond, who is an award-winning professor of chemistry at the University of Oregon and a member of the State Board of Higher Education, and Bob Turner, who is the president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate and also an associate professor of biology at Western Oregon University and the head of its honors program. So thank you.
Good morning.
Please identify yourself again for the record and start at your own convenience.
I shall. My name is Jerry Richmond. I come to you from the University of Oregon, where I've been a faculty member for 20 years in the Department of Chemistry with alliances with the Material Science Institute, the Oregon Optical Science Institute, and the Department of Physics.
For the record, my name is Bob Turner. I'm the president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate and an associate professor of biology at Western Oregon University.
I will start in with trying to give you a picture of the enterprise that we have at our universities in research. And it's the reason I pause is because the research is so intimately tied with the teaching that it's hard to decouple them. So what I'm going to tell you about are activities that we have and people that we have doing research at our institutions. But keep in mind that whenever I talk about research, it has such an important arm in terms of teaching, because it is where we allow students to be part of the larger national and international enterprise of discovery. So what I have for you are a series of, it's my little photo album for you, are some of the people that we have on our faculty and that are engaged in research. Let me start out by briefly describing what the enterprise is. We not only have research at our large institutions, but we also have research at our smaller institutions, and these are just pictures, for example, from Eastern as well as OIT, and I have this up here so that you can understand that research is not just important at the large institutions, but also the small ones. In the next slide, I've tried to put together a picture of what it is to do research at these universities and what's involved, and I apologize for it being pretty busy, but it seemed to me the most comprehensive way to describe it in a succinct manner. Faculty members, as many of you know, are hired with seed funding from OUS, and that seed funding then is what gets these people started, and getting them started in their first year and performing as quickly as possible to come up to speed to have a national and international reputation. The tenure decision is then based upon, at most of our universities, both excellence in teaching and research, and the way one is granted tenure is by going out for external letters from people around the world to find out in those 5 years if that person has established an internationally recognized program. So it's not an easy task that we put people up to get tenure, but once they do get tenure, we hope that they will continue to operate in a manner that will be productive for the students as well as the institutions. In that faculty member's life are students in the research enterprise, student participants, graduate students, and postdocs. For example, in my laboratory, I have 8 graduate students, 2 postdoctoral associates, and 2 undergraduate students. In order to keep them fed and healthy, we must pay their salaries, because most of their salaries come from federal grants that we raise. I have 9 federal grants that I have to renew annually that come to about $600,000 or $700,000 a year, and that pays their salary and their tuition. And because I do very expensive research with lasers, it keeps the lasers going and the optics and so forth. The research funding pays for undergraduates to do part-time study. Graduate students, you're paying the full, the graduate students make about $20,000 a year in chemistry, plus tuition and overhead. And postdoctoral associates, the salaries in my field are on the order of $35,000 to $40,000, and that's just sort of what we need to pay them in order to do the research. And again, all of that comes from external funds. or a very large portion. The undergraduates, graduate students, and postdocs are the ones that are helping develop their research ideas, and you watch them mature from where you're giving them ideas to where they're fighting with you because they think they have better ideas. And that's where you want them to be when they leave you. Once they leave us, they go on to become the undergraduates, bachelor's, technical staff positions, sometimes just washing dishes, unfortunately, and that's why many of them choose to go on to an advanced degree and to get a master's, a PhD. They then become managers of companies, start their own companies, become faculty members at other institutions. Postdoctoral associates generally are geared towards going in to become faculty positions. Most of my postdoctoral associates have gone on to take faculty positions at other institutions such as Ohio State and Missouri and Boston University and Lewis and Clark, so all over the country. And I'm just one simple example of the many faculty that we have that operate in the same mode that I do. So the research is intimately tied to the educational mission. Research funding is not easy to come by. Success rates for each particular grant is somewhere on the order of 15% of the grants proposals get funded. Sometimes, if you're lucky, 30% of them get funded. So of the 9 that I told you that I have, every day I worry about whether I'm going to get the next one renewed. We all do that. And particularly with the national budget the way it is now, the federal budget the way it is now, and declining resources for science, the graphs that are shown on this page will certainly go down. We've had stable funding in the physical sciences for a number of years and increasing funding in the life sciences. But those numbers are, we know, are going to go down the next number of years. So we're all just hoping we can stay alive and continue to be able to employ our students and educate them in the manner that we think is top rate. The next slides I have for you are just a series, again, of photo albums of spectacular faculty that we have, just examples of the many that we have that operate in the mode of teaching their classes every day in addition to keeping this research enterprise going. And many of these faculty are not just teaching graduate courses, they're teaching the undergraduate courses, sometimes in rooms of 400 students at a time. Rob Horner at the U of O in special education, tremendous amount of accomplishments and funding on the order of $33 million in the time that he's been at the U of O. Sherry Cady at PSU in geomicrobiology and astrobiology, the Department of Geology, does wonderful research in the area of biofilms and a very hot topic in geology. PSU is extremely lucky to have her, as is OSU to have Jane Lubchenco, who is really a diamond in the crown jewel of the faculty that we have at our institutions. Not only has she had just an incredible record in being a leader in one of the best departments in the country with regards to marine ecology and biology, but she's also served on the National Science Board, which is and is a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Just a spectacular woman and continues to bring in funding and contribute to the system. Gregory Jones from Southern in geography, climatologist, again to demonstrate that not only is research going on at our larger institutions, but also at our smaller institutions. Oops. Helen Neville will tell you how your brain works and when it doesn't work, why it doesn't work, or at least that's certainly the goal of her research and doing studies with regards to brain development and imaging and neuroscience. Let me just skip through Rob Dash. I'm going back and forth just to see if you're keeping up with me. Robert Dash at PSU, another fantastic faculty member in electrical and computer engineering. So again, there are lots of details about these faculty, but I only bring them to you as examples of what we're all doing while we also do what most people think is the only thing that we do, or a lot of people, to keep our teach in science classes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Duffman, may I ask you on the graph with the various different sciences. Life sciences obviously jumps off the page in the amount there, and it does not include engineering, physical sciences, environmental science. What does life sciences entail?
Life sciences is NIH's budget, so the National Institute of Health. And they set on a mission to double their budget several years ago in 5 years. And so Congress has poured a tremendous amount of money into the life sciences and biology and medical research largely. So there are a lot of congressmen that worry about their health. But it also shows a tremendous surge in interest in biology and medicine and the life sciences and how that integrates with a lot of other disciplines. And so that's the reason that, it's a lot easier to sell biology and health, certainly health, to constituents than it is for a new semiconductor, unfortunately. So the physical sciences have stayed fairly constant. And I myself have personally testified before U.S. Congress on issues of trying to get the physical science budget up, but you can see how successful I've been.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative Wisdom. Just for my own information, how's the Defense Department grants going? Is it, you said, in the forecast for that?
The Defense Department is becoming much, and I have, for example, money from the Office of Naval Research, and that looks like it might be stable for a while, but my program 5 years ago had 20 PIs that program officer supported, and now I'm one of five. And so those numbers have really dropped down. Where there is increased funding is, of course, national security, but that tends to be money that's very targeted towards very applied research, trying to solve problems that need to be solved right away. And a lot of the research that we do at universities is really on the scale of 5 years or 10 years in the future. So it's helped in with regards to very, very short-term research, but not so much in the long-term funding that universities generally go after.
Please proceed.
Let me skip through the photo album. And so I think what I'll do now is just summarize by saying that, you know, we at faculty that are at the universities that are involved in research feel very passionate that this research is not only important for our students, but also for the economic development in this state. And you've heard a bit about that before, and we'll continue to hear more about that. What I haven't touched upon is the fact is that this research leads to the beginnings of new companies that many of the faculty start, as well as their offspring start companies in Oregon, and we hope to be able to keep them here so we continue to generate a knowledge base that not only comes from the universities, but also our offspring. So if I'll open this up to any more questions, otherwise I'll turn it over to Bob.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Chair Devlin, members of the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, good morning. Again, for the record, my name is Bob Turner. I'm president of the Oregon University System Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, and I'm an associate professor of biology at Western Oregon University. For the next few minutes, I will address excellence in teaching by sketching for you the student-centered ways that faculty spend their time outside the classroom, and offer a few specific cases of the importance of this aspect of faculty work for the success of our students. The items on this slide were pulled out of faculty submissions when they were asked to describe a day in the life of faculty. Faculty time is devoted to a wide range of tasks that require time outside the classroom. I will use the next few slides to offer comments on some of these tasks. These comments are drawn largely from my experience and observations of my Western Oregon University colleagues, which I assume to be typical of Oregon University System faculty. I've left some time at the conclusion of my comments to respond to your questions. Grading assignments, scoring, and maintaining records of student work and preparing for lectures and labs occupy a substantial amount of faculty time. Oregon University System's regional institutions require 12 hours per week in class each term, which easily generates another 18 to 24 hours of time for grading, scoring, and preparation. This is a heavy teaching load, and it is as important as the relatively low compensation for Oregon University System faculty in causing faculty to leave the Oregon University System. This spring, Western Oregon University found out that we are losing a highly respected young mathematics professor due to the combination of heavy workload and low compensation. Curricular change and development is not driven by faculty whim, but faculty perception of the need to present current material to our students. Topics such as terrorism, genetic engineering, global warming, obesity, and antibiotic-resistant disease organisms have been incorporated into the curricula of departments from philosophy to history to chemistry. More important drivers of curricular change are changes in the incoming student population, changes in the aspirations of the students, and faculty desire that our students leave our institutions ready to apply successfully for jobs and for positions in graduate and professional schools. Instituting curricular change requires both writing the new curriculum and presenting it to comment and approval by various departmental, institutional, and in cases of programmatic changes, Oregon University System committees. Providing accurate academic advice and career counseling requires not only that faculty meet with their advisees. In my unit at Western Oregon University, the number of advisees ranges from 15 to over 90 advisees, depending upon the faculty member, but that the faculty member also devote time to keeping abreast of changes in workplace, graduate, and professional school expectations. Special study sessions should perhaps be included under course preparation. One sort of special assignment is the review session that is held before each exam or other major assignment for the students. Most committees focus directly on improving student success. Every scholarship and every award a student receives for success in academic, athletic, student government, or student life requires reading and evaluating all applications. This work goes on outside the committee meetings, and then committee meetings for discussion and selection of the successful applicant. Sometimes extra ad hoc efforts are required by a committee. One case in which that happened dealt with a student who was going to leave Western Oregon University because he needed to increase his financial resources by working. This is a student who 2 years ago was the winner, one of 30 winners of a national grant. Faculty organized around this student and arranged for him to receive additional financial help so that he could remain in school. Instructional effectiveness research goes on at each campus. The introduction of new technology and efforts to increase teaching efficiency occur on every campus. These efforts require the development, execution, and assessment of the programs to accomplish this goal, all of which take faculty time. The most important student mentoring is personal rather than academic. In one case, a Western Oregon University Honors Program student was going to withdraw from school after her father's death in an automobile accident. The student turned to her faculty educators for personal support. Several faculty spent hours helping this student arranging for accommodation in her academic work. The result was that she stayed in school, wrote her honors thesis on deaf education, was named the outstanding female graduate in her class, and is now teaching in an Oregon Coast elementary school. All faculty research requires publication to be recognized. Manuscript preparation is more than just sitting down and writing the paper. A typical manuscript is submitted for publication only after undergoing several drafts. It is then reviewed by peers at other institutions and usually needs to be revised to address the reviewer's comments. All of this takes time. The best guarantee that a faculty member remains current in their field is that they are engaged in research. As Dr. Richmond pointed out, undergraduate research is extremely student-centered, for these students have a great deal of one-on-one contact with faculty. The research experience is the major benefit for the student. The additional gains include letters of reference from a faculty member who really knows the student, and the experience of publicly presenting their research, as one Western Oregon University student will do in Washington, D.C. later this spring. I now offer four examples of faculty whose work exemplifies the teaching that we do. The first of these is Dr. Hank Bersani from Western Oregon University. I know personally of Dr. Bersani's commitment to teaching because he demonstrated it within the last few weeks when he agreed to step in as the advisor for an undergraduate thesis when circumstances prevented the original advisor from continuing. Through Dr. Bersani's efforts at rapidly familiarizing himself with the 15 months of planning and work that the student had already invested in this thesis, the student will complete the thesis on time. I am an archaeologist, confesses Associate Professor Madonna Moss. Undergraduates and graduate students who enroll and participate in one of Moss's classes proclaim that she is far more. She is a consummate teacher of archaeology. Since her initial appointment in the Department of Anthropology in 1990, Madonna Moss has earned a stellar teaching record and has distinguished herself as an innovator, a teacher who will not settle for mediocrity for herself and her students, and a compassionate mentor. Her sustained and significant accomplishments in teaching were recognized as the recipient of the 2000 Thomas F. Herman Faculty Achievement Award for Distinguished Teaching. Dr. Leslie Burns has been recognized nationally and internationally for her 20 years of accomplishments in analyzing the textile industries. Dr. Burns has also received the Bressler Senior Faculty Teaching Award from Oregon State University and the National Educator of the Year Award from the Apparel Industry, from Apparel Industry Magazine. Finally, Dr. Gonzalez Viana, who is the recipient of national and international literary awards and continues to write a column for Spanish language publications, pardon me, is recognized by his students and his peers as a rigorous instructor committed to the success of his students, a commitment that is demonstrated in the classroom and in one-on-one instruction. Since every Oregon University institution annually recognizes an outstanding educator, it would be possible to continue to show slides praising these educators. I end this presentation with the hope that these comments have enriched the image elicited for you by the phrase, excellence in education. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and welcome any questions you may have.
Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Jensen.
I'm curious on your statements about advisors and the number of advisees, 90 advisees. What exactly is required of an advisor?
The advisor's task is to make sure that the students receive accurate advice that will lead them to their career goals. And I can speak directly to those 90 students because until this fall I advised them they're pre-nursing students. They spend 2 years at an undergraduate institution or community college and then apply for competitive application for admission to OHSU's bachelor's program or the bachelor's programs at Linfield or University of Portland. Those students need to know exactly what courses they need to be taking when during the 2 years they're at that undergraduate level, the first 2 years.
So, in essence, these are pretty self-directed students when you get into that number of 90.
I would dispute that representation of the students. Some of them are very self-directed. The bulk of them needs direction, and they need to be convinced that it's necessary for them to start with a sequence in chemistry and biology if they're going to get through the pre-nursing program in 2 years, as one illustration.
Mr. Chair, if I could editorialize. My hat certainly goes off to a staff member spending the time with anything approaching that number of advisees. That's a tremendous load, and certainly requires considerable dedication on the part of a staff member to put that time of type and time into the job that they have. I have some experience with advising college students, and at least from that experience, 90 advisees staggers me. I think I maybe ran 40 or 45, and that staggered me. So,
if I could interject, it staggers me as well. And I will not contend that all 90 of those students are receiving equal time. A lot of for that number of students, the students do have to be somewhat self-directed.
That's part of my point. But even just even shuffling the paper for 90 students every quarter gets to be a huge chore. So again, my hat goes off to the university faculty who take on that type of chore.
question to both Professor Richmond and to Professor Turner. Since one of you is at the land-grant institution, or one of the big three, and one of you is from a regional, is there a difference in expectation in terms of research and publication, do you think, between the types of institutions?
Yes. But that doesn't make the task any easier, one or the other. But there certainly is a larger expectation for research at a large institution, I would say, than at a smaller institution. But increasingly, the bar has been raised at the larger institutions for making a good balance between excellence in research and teaching. And it used to be that to get tenure, it was largely based on how good you did research, but now you won't get tenure if you don't also do well in teaching. And that's a very healthy change that not all large institutions across the country have shifted to.
And again, I'll speak from my own experience at Western. As my tenure file progressed, and when I sat on the personnel review committee reviewing tenure files for other individuals, research is an essential part of successful progress through the ranks. Although at Western, teaching is 50% of the expectation for advancement to tenure. But if you have excellent teaching credentials and no research record, you will not be advanced to tenure or promoted.
Follow up to Professor Turner. Do you think that there is it's part of the retention issue at regionals that professors want to have, faculty members want to have the opportunity for research? I mean,
no, I think that an individual who applies for a position at a regional, by the time they make that application, have their eyes pretty wide open with respect to the expectations, number one. And number two, when they apply, the faculty handbook, at least at Western, spells out very clearly the expectations for promotion. And it is clear that at those institutions, teaching is the primary goal of the primary job of the faculty member. With respect to people leaving, it is not so much the teaching as it is the amount of teaching. And 12 hours, a 12-hour teaching load is a heavy load. And the mathematics teacher that is leaving is not leaving to go to a research institution. She's leaving to go to St. Martin's College outside of Olympia, Washington, which is not a Research One institution. It's also a teaching institution.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
I would like to, at this time, introduce the next presenter, who is Dr. Gretchen Schutte, who is the president of Chemeketa Community College and a member of the Oregon University System Board of Directors.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gretchen Schutte, for the record, president of Chemeketa Community College and also member of the State Board of Higher Education. And in a moment, I will introduce my colleague here after making my presentation, if that's all right. I am here to report to you on some of the activities of the work group that I chair for the State Board of Higher Education Excellence in Delivery and Productivity work group. And as you know, this work group was formed to create a platform that would increase student access for Oregonians to college and also to support success in completing college goals and college degrees. And we do this work on the State Board of Higher Education and on the work group to help Oregon's colleges and universities keep that promise of opportunity and equity for all Oregonians. As we did our work on the work group, we committed that each initiative must positively impact students and communities of diverse backgrounds, including first generation to college, low income, minority, older, working, and transfer students. And that was at the heart of our work right from the beginning. from that beginning, and this was some 14 months ago, the work group was a very collaborative effort. Education colleagues developed an agenda for our work through active and open discussion, sometimes extremely active. But from the beginning, the work had three critical traits. First, all of the activities and policies would be student-centered. That is, they would focus on ways to assist students in their efforts to pursue and complete education, and we would adopt the student view, not the institution view or the sector view. Second, the activities would be collaboratively developed and implemented with partners from the K-12 community college and university sectors, and we would all be equal partners at the table. And finally, ours would be a statewide focus so that students in every part of the state would benefit from our efforts. We would stay alert to diverse needs across the state, rural as well as urban, east as well as west, north as well as south, students from diverse backgrounds. And our work would not be to kind of point out and tally up a good program here and one there, but rather to identify what are the collaborations and system changes that would have statewide impact and the potential to reach every Oregonian. So as the State Board of Higher Education work group crafted an action plan, there were right from the beginning an obvious seven areas that could give us some initial traction on our goals. And we did look for impact as soon as possible, impact that could be felt immediately in the first year or in the second year. And even those immediate changes we recognized might cost time and effort, and both were in short supply, but the commitment was so large we just got going. We also recognized that any efforts beyond the initial ones needed to build upon some momentum if we could get it, and some accomplishments if we could have them. And I'm here to try to characterize that we did get some momentum and we have had some accomplishments. But it is expected that future efforts will also require a lot of effort and certainly some financial support in order to be successfully implemented. And so we believe we will probably go to the Chancellor's Office, to the Commissioner's Office, individual colleges and universities, granting groups, and also with your support to you in the future as necessary to make some appropriate financial requests. I certainly want to begin, though, by saying that we intend, of course, to hold ourselves accountable and to report specific progress made and students benefited from this biennium's requests for K-12 community colleges and universities and from our collective efforts. We have had some success. I'm also want to be sure to say I feel confident that we will have more success. I want to acknowledge the work would not have been successful without strong staff support. Dave McDonald of the Chancellor's Office and also Connie Green of CCWD were instrumental in making anything get done. Also, I know that we will continue to have, and it's been demonstrated, the commitment of the University Provost, the Acting Chancellor, the Community College Commissioner, and Community College Academic and Student Services Leader, so more will be accomplished. But the rate of success and the numbers of students who can be impacted by a more efficient way to deliver an excellent education are to a degree dependent on adequate funding for K-12 community colleges and universities for essential activities. Without adequate funding for enrollment and basic costs, the efforts of the work group will continue because we care so deeply, but those efforts will pull against a strong and chilling tide that pushes us further from our goal of providing all Oregonians with a high-quality education. I apologize for the metaphor. I tried to think of something about volcanoes because of the immediate images that we have, but instead I'll stick with the metaphor of trying to push against a very strong and chilling tide of inadequate resources. I spoke with this subcommittee as part of the community college presentations about the activities of the Excellence in Delivery and Productivity Work Group, and it tickles me to demonstrate just by being here, speaking for the university system, demonstrating the collaborative nature of our work. I will again summarize the seven areas of activity that we are pursuing, of course acknowledging maybe in a redundant fashion, but again the University Provost, but also the Community College Council of Instructional Administrators and Council of Student Services Administrators, critical work of those groups. In addition, we have on the work group three other OUS board members. We have community college presidents from Clackamas and Portland Community College Rock Creek, a retired academic leader from Clatsop Community College, someone who's currently a member of the Oregon Business Council, and also a leader in the K-12 innovative work around small schools, and all have made important contributions. But I don't want to overemphasize the members of the work group itself. Each gathering has had at least 40 people, sometimes 60 or more, around the table. People are very eager to do this work together, work that I think is in many ways a model of collaboration and of student-focused work to achieve a statewide impact through focusing on the statewide data transfer process, general education outcomes and processes, articulation of majors and dual enrollment framework, the online delivery of courses, high-demand courses, accelerated learning opportunities for high school students, and also retention to graduation of college students. So I report progress to you, and I hope you are pleased with progress that has been accomplished to date. Each of these arenas that you see on the slide have had, in effect, co-chairs, one from the university system, one from the community college system, and in some cases, additional members in leadership roles from community colleges, university system, and K-12. Several of these focus areas also had other groups that they collaborated with in order to get the quality outcomes that we were looking for in a very short period of time. To be fair, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I do need to provide information about at least three major initiatives that were certainly well underway before the work group was even born, and give credit to those initiatives, because we certainly built on that work, and there's probably a lot of other work that I could reference as well, but I will stick with three. And first would be the dual enrollment co-admission programs between several OUS campuses and community colleges, and some of these have existed for nearly a decade, and I know you've received some information about them, but the Oregon State University and Lynn Benton Community College agreement may have been the first such agreement, and in many ways it has evolved to serve as a model for the other 22 agreements in the state. In fall 2004, nearly 4,000 students were actively enrolled in this manner and have been benefiting from the shared delivery of key services such as financial aid, academic advising, and other student services. And more cooperative works agreements are in the works, including at Clatsop. The data transfer process and also the linked audit system that I'll talk about in a moment really build on and relate to this work in dual enrollment. Certainly those pieces are key infrastructural pieces that make dual enrollment work well. As far as the Excellence in Delivery and Productivity Work Group, our focus in the dual enrollment arena has been to make known what are the key elements of an agreement about dual enrollment, and also the power of having articulation in specific majors in place before a dual enrollment agreement, so that there can be a richer benefit from having that dual enrollment agreement, and also to encourage agreements across the state so that every Oregonian would have an opportunity and access to those tools. A second thing I want to point to is the proficiency-based admission support system, PASS, the standards-based approach that was initiated in the early 90s by the university system to serve Oregon's students and schools as they were engaged in a major transition to a standards-based approach to education. The academic standards that used by PASS are, in essence, a roadmap for student learning and leading to the place that we all seek, and that is improved academic preparation for college entry. These standards were developed jointly by faculty from the OUS institutions and high schools and other colleagues. They are aligned with the 10th grade benchmarks used by Oregon's public high schools, and the efforts of PASS, as you know, have been recognized nationally by organizations such as Achieve and scholars such as Michael Kirst at Stanford University as comprising a model of alignment between K-12 and post-secondary education. And again, I hope that we can build further on this foundational work and make good use of the work already done. A final example of an important and effective current effort to increase student access to college is Oregon Gear Up. And this is a statewide collaboration among three state agencies, the Oregon Department of Education, Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and the Oregon University System, along with over 10 local and national partners. Gear Up is a $25 million program supported with federal funds and an equal match of local support. And this program has simply one goal, to increase the numbers of low-income students who go to college. Currently, Gear Up is in 39 middle and high schools in 11 counties, and it serves over 12,000 students today. It's only in its third year. It's managed through the Chancellor's Office, and it has made already very significant progress. The program starts with a seventh grade cohort of students and stays with that group through graduation while adding new cohorts each year. And I believe the impact that this program has had directly relates to the beginnings in middle school and then the following of students throughout their progress. Middle school dropout rate has declined by over 20% in Gear Up middle schools last year. The high school dropout rate declined this year by 5%, and that is particularly impressive because the Gear Up students just entered high school this year. The number of advanced placement courses has increased by nearly 200% since 1997, and the number of students taking an AP course in Gear Up High School has increased by 150%, and the number of students who earned a score of 3 or above in 2002 increased by over 160%. So terrific progress in that program. So just to briefly then touch on some of the recent accomplishments that were spurred by the Excellence in Delivery and Productivity Workgroup, I'd mention again the Oregon Transfer Module, an excellent example of doing what is right for students in a time period that many of us could never have imagined was possible. That module was pushed and pulled and delivered in a matter of months, due in large part to so many hands and so many brains at the table, but also in large part to the extreme efforts of Peter Gilkey, who I hope you get to meet. He was the president of the Oregon University System Interinstitutional Faculty Senate during the inception of this project. By day, he's this mild-mannered mathematics professor, but he was a dynamo working with the faculty senates of all seven university campuses and with many of the community college campuses, along with other colleagues, including Bob Turner, who just spoke with you, and Maureen Savigny of OIT, did incredible work to get faculty working together on this model, a model that was important for them and also important to the Joint Boards Articulation Commission. And that group also stepped up to the challenge. They've been in existence for some time, another example of cross-sector collaboration. They have had the charge of making the transfer between institutions as effective as possible, and they've been at the heart of these issues for a decade. And in this case, again, the members of that group stepped up to the challenge. They caught the energy in the air and performed magnificently to make sure that we had their engagement with the Oregon Transfer Module. So I'm very, very pleased about that. It's a one-year option. As you know, it complements the long-standing Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer degree, the AAOT, a two-year degree. The module strength will come from its flexibility for students. Students can complete courses in the module at one college, at two colleges, at three colleges or universities in the state, and all the credits will count. And when students complete this module, they will have satisfied the majority of their lower division general education requirements for all of our community colleges and all of our universities. The module, it's the beginning, not the end, of our collaborative work in general education and transfer issues. It is a sequential step in a journey related to general education, a journey that includes looking again at the Associate of Arts and continuing with the strong ASOT, the Associate of Science degree in business. Other steps will include using technology to enhance advising, to provide the tools for those advisors with so many students, and to provide the opportunity for more effective student advising. And I'll say just a little bit more about the benefits of using technology in a moment.
We have one question.
Yes.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Doctor. The dual enrollment and the modular transfer modular, and even the associate degrees. Mm-hmm. Do they transfer as just course credits, or do their grade point averages, or do any of those three, do the grades transfer for the overall GPA?
The module has a grade requirement.
No, but does that mm-hmm. transfer towards your overall university?
Yes.
So that would figure into your overall GPA?
I believe so, but you know what? I'm going to make sure and check back with you. This is a new thing. We're working on the implementation, and let me be sure we get the accurate answer back to you.
And the same thing for the dual enrollment mm-hmm. and the associate degree. I know it used to be you'd just get course credit, but it wouldn't count as your GPA mm-hmm. for the higher university.
The dual enrollment, Representative Wisnett, the dual enrollment is an expectation that you are treated fully as a student of the university at the same time that you are fully a student of the community college.
We have another question from Representative mm-hmm. Jensen.
My question has to do with the dual enrollment and mm-hmm. the Associate of Arts and Science transfer degrees and transferability. Mm-hmm. I've been exposed to this community college university system in Oregon now since a good portion of you that are in the room were in junior high school or something of that type, or before you even entered the community colleges. And starting back in the dark ages, in the 1960s, this was a constant dilemma, and it's being mm-hmm. worked on and worked on and worked on, and I can't imagine how many thousands of hours mm-hmm. of time have gone into that effort. And I'm not suggesting in any way that this is not a laudable effort for us. I think it's a requirement mm-hmm. that we should have. But my question is, are we finally over have we crossed the bridge now and we're on the other side and we can look at this thing without having to invest so much administrative and faculty and whatever else time into solving a problem that, in my humble opinion, should have been solved two decades ago?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, and other members of the committee, this addresses my largest hope for this work. I've been engaged in this work since the 70s, and I'm much older than I appear. But I have been working in this arena, particularly in Common Course numbering with regard to writing courses and other arenas. I also am weary, and my biggest hope is that because of how this work has been approached, because of the commitment of people who have gathered around this table, that we will have as a legacy something that sticks. And that we will have a legacy of process, a legacy of using the Joint Boards and the Joint Boards Articulation Commission. And I've had people from the university sector and from the community college sector say to me that we will make it stick this time. We will not drift back to seeking institutional or sector interest, but to continue to take a student-centered point of view. I share your concern about drift and barriers raising again after we look away, and that's why how we work together and the process of how we work together is as important as any one of these products that I'm pointing to. But that is the commitment that I hold and that I have seen in others around the table. We're going to do it this time so it doesn't need to be done again in the next decade or the next decade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just make one closing comment. My initial statement in referring to the time elements, you would have been one of those I thought was in junior high school.
I was hoping that you thought that. Well, thank you for helping me to get through some of the comments that I had penciled in to make as well. I want to just speak briefly to the data concerns we have. The governor's budget does fund the data system of the state's three educational sectors, a data transfer system, a pipeline that will transmit student transcripts on demand between and among high schools, community colleges, and universities. And we're not talking about a new data system, but rather about a collaborative and statewide effort to link systems and to facilitate advising for students at all schools and reduce some of the delay in the admission process for students, reducing some of their stress, also allowing community colleges and university campuses to become more efficient in their data entry of transcript information to their student information systems. So we will have savings in each sectors. We hope, and certainly I hope we will have and believe that we will have, a more transparent and efficient set of processes to support students in this arena. And then finally, the Atlas strength through our articulated transfer linked audit system. Here we've had representatives from Mount Hood Community College, Portland State University, and the University of Oregon developing the articulated transfer linked audit system. And this is a web-based tool that would allow students across the state to access information on how courses are accepted and how they are used to meet degree requirements for the OUS campuses. The next phase of this work would be to support the development of degree audit systems at all community colleges so that students there and advisors there would also be able to determine how their courses transfer among community colleges and universities as well. And I think I referenced the importance of community college participation in my remarks when I was before the committee for the community college system. I really believe this, the effectiveness of this system will grow again as we have this legacy of working together, university and community college colleagues together reviewing community college courses and university courses and determining how courses can apply toward degree requirements. So we have a lot of excitement around this Atlas program, and I think it holds great promise for the future, and I believe you'll hear more about that in phase two. And I'm coming to the end. I do want to mention one further area of progress, and that is student retention. We've had a team of colleagues from Lynn Benton Community College, Portland Community College, the Chancellor's Office, and Western Oregon University collecting information about best practices in student retention from the community colleges and OUS institutions. And this is an extremely important effort for us. The gathering information was an initial step toward creating an Oregon Student Success Center, a resource center focused on the success of each and every student and the completion of their college goals. And we have crafted a federal funding request, thanks to Western Oregon University, on behalf of all the public post-secondary education institutions in Oregon. The other arenas of activity that are shown on the slide are progressing in their design work, but are likely to be quite limited, many of us feel, in their activities until we can agree on ways to get additional funding or allocation of funds to address distance education, bottleneck courses where students don't have as many opportunities as they need to proceed through key courses in their career programs, and accelerated learning opportunities for high school is also a very important focus for us, and look forward to working with you more in that arena. So I would conclude by saying that the work has been exhausting, exhilarating. We're moving rapidly, and we are moving collaboratively to better meet the needs of students and to increase the number of Oregonians who are able to benefit from a college and a college degree. A lot of initial progress through the intelligent and dedicated and caring work of educators from community colleges and universities. Certainly, we have much more work to do to create that platform for student access that we all envision, that one that is the one I see in my dreams and the one that I still hold out hope for. We have the power to do that. It's really the time, I believe, for us to make and keep an ongoing commitment to invest in Oregon's future by supporting the educational enterprise today. Rather than being pulled from shore by the tide of inadequate funding and also the undertows of competing interests, we need to collectively climb together on the top of that surfboard and hold hands and get to the shore of student needs and our state's future. And I think it will be a very enjoyable ride because we are doing it together and for the best purpose. And I thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions before introducing my colleague here.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I missed most of your presentation. I was in another committee presenting some bills this morning. But I always enjoy having you here, Dr. Schutte, and I appreciate your analogies. I'm going to, when I finally get to meet Mr. Gilkey, I'm going to imagine him climbing into a phone booth and putting on his cape, because by day he's someone else, and by night he turns into some other Superman. So thank you for all your work.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate what you bring to the table, and appreciate your presentation this morning.
Thank you.
I'd like to say the same thing and say I'm hoping that we haven't put too great of a burden on you, because you come to us as a community college president, a member of the Board of Higher Education, and you are close by. So you're often called upon to be here. So, yes, Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Dr. Schutte, I share yours and Representative Jensen's concern about the amount of time this has taken. Just an anecdote, I started my higher education at Central Oregon College when it was a night school on the campus of the Bend High School. And way back in the fossil age, as Representative Jensen can attest to, my credits and GPA transferred seamlessly to Oregon State University and then on to Washington State University Professional School in Veterinary Medicine. That was 40 years ago. And you are still trying to solve the problem that wasn't a problem 40 years ago. And I wonder if that is a symptom of an underlying problem with our education system, that we tend to study and negotiate something to death rather than just do it.
May I comment?
Yes.
Senator Devlin, Senator Whitson, and other members of the committee. I think you have, at the current moment in time, and also at other periods in our history as well, people who do just want to get it done and get it done right for the students' interests. And I also want to say that there are many, many, many good things going on right now, and also a lot of good, including in the whole arena of credits counting and effective transfer. What we are trying to do is really address the barriers, and they are substantial in some cases and easy to push down in others. And our intention is to take that focus of every student across the state and eliminate those barriers so that we don't continue to, so that we can feel good about what is possible and what can be done. But it will take some persistence in establishing how we continue to refresh those good things and make sure that they do stay and stick. I don't think we're going to overstudy at this time. When we first came to the table, it was obvious what needed to be done. and we've just gotten a hair clearer on it, and we've made progress in educational terms at the speed of light. And we will continue to do that with your support.
Thank you, and I compliment you for your efforts.
And Dr. Shute, if you now introduce the next speaker, and I would keep the testifiers in mind that we have spent about an hour and 10 minutes on what was supposed to be about 30 minutes of our agenda, and we have about 40 minutes left of the agenda to do in about 50 minutes, so we need to stay on schedule for this.
It is a pleasure to introduce Alec Svila, who is a participant in a dual enrollment program. He is an LBCC Roadrunner and an OSU Beaver.
Good morning, Chair.
Good morning. Identify yourself again for the record.
For the record, my name is Alec Svila. Good morning, Chair Devlin and members of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. I am a second-year dual-enrolled student at both Oregon State University and Lynn Benning Community College. I started the dual enrollment since I was a senior in high school. I got a lot of information on the dual enrollment, and I was a very successful high school student that allowed me to enroll in the dual enrollment, and I saw it as for my college career as an opportunity for taking a variety of classes, both small and large, opportunity to make friends, and receiving a very rich experience of gaining both the small Thai community at LBCC and the large community, but still organized university life. My previous experiences with the dual enrollment has allowed me to be available to participate in many activities at Oregon State and LBCC, such as in Oregon State, I participated in the OSU marching band as a percussionist, wearing earplugs all the time so I couldn't really hear anything. And I'm gaining really a full sense of the Oregon State spirit, and during that good old Civil War achievement with with having my brother going to U of O, really has the attention up there. And for the participation at LBCC, as soon as you walk into the LBCC courtyard, there's many activities going on, especially when spring's coming around. You have a many varieties of buying hot dogs or buying like a dollar per ball for a dunk tank for like, you know, dunking your worst or your favorite teacher. So much fun, and as well as LBCC is offering a in one room, not in several buildings, as Oregon State, that LBCC offers many opportunities for help with classes and many varieties of subjects. They work with you, and as well as Oregon State, you can go from building to building and get good exercise. And the dual enrollment as well has helped me financially, just filling out one application for both schools instead of like going back and forth. I am also a recipient of the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Federal Pell Grant, as well as four other scholarships of my first year, last year, with the E.E. Wilson Scholarship Fund, Ambassadors Club, LB Scholar Award, and also some help from my family. I have some other background of me. I've lived in the Willamette Valley for a long time now, and my future plans are to go to Lyon, France, for my major. My major is geography with an international degree in French, with a senior thesis in researching the differences and the comparison between Burgundy wine and Oregon wine with the new age and the old world, and can't wait to do the hands-on research. Anything else I should ask?
He's an Eagle Scout.
From Troop 1. I've kept my attitudes high, being really optimistic in anything that I do. I'm a very active person. The Scouts allowed me to look at all the opportunities that both schools have to offer, and I a very and a great time of my life, and I'll pay it back eventually.
Any questions?
Thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are you going to introduce your next panel?
I am. It's a pleasure to introduce Adriana Mendoza. She will be coming to speak with you along with a panel of students. Adriana is a student at Eastern Oregon University, and she is also a member of the State Board of Higher Education and a member of the Excellence in Delivery and Productivity Work Group.
Chair Devlin, members of the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, good morning. For the record, my name is Adriana Mendoza, and I am a student member of the State Board of Higher Education and a student in my third year at Eastern Oregon University studying Business Administration and Business Economics. We've tried to do a thorough job of getting you the information you need to do your work and to bring in representatives from our campuses and our board who can best deliver this information. It is an honor to be with you today. We welcome your questions and comments at any point throughout our brief presentations. Throughout today and next week's hearings, when you are focused on the issues and on the budget of the OUS, we must keep reminding each other the reason we are all here, the education of Oregon students, our future. This morning, I'm going to briefly provide an overview of who our students are, where they come from, and what helps them be successful on our campuses. Other students will speak this morning on their experiences on an OUS campus and provide more specific examples. As you can see in these pie charts, the majority of OUS students are resident undergraduates, over half of whom enter directly after graduating from Oregon high schools, about 42%, or out-of-state high schools, 11.2%. A growing portion of our undergraduates, almost 20%, enter OUS after attending a community college. This is an important pipeline of talented students into our four-year colleges and will likely become even more critical as the numbers of transferring students grow due to initiatives now underway between two- and four-year colleges and universities in Oregon. More on this later, though. Almost a quarter of our students are over the age of 25, and at some institutions in particular, such as PSU and OSU Cascades, a large portion attend part-time, again, almost one quarter system-wide. Some of these students are parents, many of them work, and many of them juggle a number of responsibilities outside of their academic work that make getting through college even more of an accomplishment and a challenge than in the past. As you can see from the growing numbers of students of color, OUS campuses have worked hard to provide opportunities to underrepresented minority students. Since 1998, while overall OUS enrollment has increased 23%, the enrollment of African American students has increased 54%, and the enrollment of Hispanic Latino students has increased 42%. Enrollment of American Indian and Alaskan Native students continues to grow at a below average rate of just 16% since 1998. Asian American students continue to show strong enrollment, growing by 34% since 1998. I cannot stress enough how important it is that our campuses reflect the diversity of our communities and our workplaces. All students benefit from interacting with others who they may not have an opportunity to associate with in their communities and their schools. This is our world, and we must learn to live in it among our wonderful diversity if we are to thrive and contribute to our communities. An important role of our OUS campuses is helping all of us learn, live, and work together in an environment of inclusion, understanding, and equity. While across the state, students have access to four-year degree programs through our seven campuses, our two university centers, and the Bend OSU Cascades campus, there are still disparities in access in certain parts of Oregon. By increasing educational attainment rates for students at all income levels, we are enriching the pool of Oregonians who are qualified for top-level jobs. thereby lowering the need to import as many professionals to fill the slots that we cannot with our own native graduates. This has a positive impact on our economy as well. The cost of college in our state can be a high hurdle, if not a brick wall, for many students. Yet with the proposed increases in the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the wall can be scaled, the hurdle lowered, so that every Oregon student with aspirations for post-secondary education will be able to pursue their educational goals. As a student, it might seem strange that I would advocate for a tuition increase, but my fear with the tuition freeze is that ultimately there would be an even larger tuition increase once the freeze was over, and students would not be able to plan for it. Moderate tuition increases, the amount of which is communicated to students well in advance, gives us the ability to plan, increasing the likelihood that students won't need to stop out or drop out because of the costs. What makes Oregon students successful and ready to contribute to the Oregon economy at graduation? Much of this boils down to the quality of instruction that we receive from our faculty on campus and the outlets that are available to practice our work through internships, research projects, and community service, to name just a few. I would now like to turn this over to a few other students who will tell you more about their experiences and work at OUS institutions. Thank you. Any questions?
We'll hold until the end.
Okay.
So. For the record, my name is Jeremy Gregory. I'm a senior graduating this year from Oregon State University. And I'd like to begin by thanking you all, Chairman Devlin and members of the committee, for allowing me to appear here today. My goal, like everyone else who's already spoke and those who will speak, is just to put a face on higher education in Oregon, to inform you on some of the great things happening at our institutions of learning, and to give you a chance to ask questions directly of us who are in the system. We as students depend on the conclusions you reach and the recommendations you make, and we want to make sure you know how we feel. The time I've enjoyed as an undergraduate at OSU has been defined by a great number of opportunities. Opportunities of several types that will, each in its own way, first, help me get into medical school, but second and more important, help me practice good medicine and be a good physician. I think there's a lot of positive work to be done in the world, and my contribution, at least, will be as a learned, well-trained, and compassionate physician. If you will indulge me for just a few minutes, I would like to share how my path into the field of medicine is being cleared by the successes I have enjoyed as a scholar, a leader, and a servant of our community. These, I think, are not only qualities central to the student experience, but also to the practice of responsible citizenship, and that goes for Oregon or any other state. In terms of scholastic opportunities at Oregon State, I first have to mention the University Honors College, and this is a program that is mirrored at other institutions in the system. I know the UHC at OSU, so that's what I'll talk about. That program has allowed me to construct a rather unusual combination of majors and minors, tailored to my particular interests in medicine, medical science, and the practice of these. I'll graduate in June, as I said, with three honors baccalaureates in biochemistry and biophysics, in Spanish and international studies. Did I have to be a member of the Honors College to have multiple majors? No. But the undergraduate research I conducted and the senior thesis I'm now writing surely gave me a leg up in some of those courses and forced me to understand the subject matter quite a bit better than I think some of my peers. Specifically, I spent last summer determining the gene sequences of several Newton melanocortin receptors. In other words, I was isolating the DNA codes, those A's, T's, C's, and G's that we hear about in the news, for a certain subset of proteins that we can find in the newt, the rough skin newt, an amphibian about like this, and us, a decidedly more complex organism, I think. In the thesis, I'm examining the evolutionary tree that actually connects us and them, as well as focusing on the human version of one of these receptors, because it is a genetic marker of skin color variation and hair color variation with geographic latitude. That's to say that at the equator, we normally see darker skin and darker hair, where because the ultraviolet light is the most intense and we need protection against that. But as you move north with different human populations, you tend to see lighter skin and hair. They need to activate the vitamin D. They need to actually absorb the light. I'm just my thesis is looking into the biochemistry underlying this evolutionary trend. I know that makes me a nerd, but I find it exciting. Another academic opportunity that has added significantly to my undergraduate experience and preparation to be a physician, I think, has been the teaching assistantship I currently hold under Dr. Glenn Evans for the physical chemistry sequence. As a student helping students in a 400-level chemistry course, I'm forced to learn and understand the material inside and out, of course. I think that's a given. but I also have to work to develop the communication skills to be able to explain to students who may never have considered the chemical reactions or the world around them in terms of vector calculus. I have to be able to explain that to them and hopefully pass along some of the understanding that I gained last year as a student in the course. In fact, I believe effective communication is absolutely critical to the practice of good medicine, and being a teaching assistant at OSU is just one of the opportunities that that university has given me to prepare for my profession. I promised I would also divulge a bit about being a leader and a community servant. I think the best way to do that in the few remaining moments I have is to talk about the year I spent as an exchange student in Quito, Ecuador. From August 2002 through July 2003, I was, again, as I said, in Quito and studying at the Pontifical Catholic University there, a semi-public private institution there in the capital city. Definitely different than my experience in Corvallis or my hometown of Pendleton. 2 million people versus 15,000. You can imagine the disparities. I think I achieved at least an initial mastery of the Spanish language and the Latin American culture that I hope to work into my practice in the future. But I also know that I developed dozens of relationships with Ecuadorians and people from all over the globe that will last many, many years. I think the study abroad programs, while they surely benefit the individuals who participate, myself included, they have served an even larger role as ambassadorial opportunities for our state and our country. I volunteered in a medical clinic while I was in Quito, prepping patients for endocrinology consultations and actually participating in quite a few procedures while I was down there. And it was such a great experience that I plan, and I know I'll make international outreach part of my medical practice in a few years. To conclude, I would just like to finally pose the question that I've spent the last several minutes answering, and that is, what am I getting out of my education? I'm getting opportunities to develop myself personally, as a scientist and a communicator, as a teacher and a practitioner, really. I'm acquiring skills for my career and for my life. And I am now, and I think I hope to forever be, a scholar, a leader, and a community servant. And I'll now answer questions or turn it over. Thank you.
I will change the practice a little bit since, Mr. Mendoza, you will be here for the duration. Mr. Gregory probably will step down. So if there are any questions for Mr. Gregory, I understand that there are some. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but simply a recognition that Mr. Gregory is a constituent of mine. He is one of the products of Pendleton High School, and he also happens to be, and his family happen to be friends. I taught with his father, was up to college for a few years while I was still there. They attend the same church that we do, and Mr. Gregory also is always welcome back at home at the church, because he plays in the bell choir with us there. And if I need to say, and I probably shouldn't, but if I need to say that Mr. Gregory, we are extremely proud of him, and certainly wish him the best of luck in his continued pursuit of education. And as I told him this morning, my hope is that he will return to Pendleton to practice medicine. Actually, my hope would have been that he would return to practice in the area of geriatrics, so I might have
Thank you, Representative Jensen. I would also just like to point out that it's just a turn of fate that I'm here today. He was actually not the one who invited me, although I'm very happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the presentation. Obviously, you're a future leader, and you'll be able to look after my grandchildren, so I appreciate your testimony. Since we have you here and you're very articulate, could you tell us a little bit about your experiences in the OUS system? As an undergraduate, did you have some 100-level courses that you had hundreds or 30 people, or what size of class? And could you talk, I know from, you know, we read about the PhDs we have in our system. Did you really feel you had contact with them, or were you always working with a graduate student? Could you comment on those two issues, please?
I could. I entered Oregon State with a fair amount of advanced placement credit, so I didn't have any 100-level courses, but I did have 200-level courses that met just those criteria, being in the 600-student range, biology, the general biology sequence being a good example of that. Did I have access to the doctors, the professors, and the answer is yes. Even with 600 students, when the student makes the effort, I think the access is there. I also point to the Honors College, the general chemistry sequence. While those courses generally have about 120 students in them to 150, and you could argue that perhaps they don't have the access, I was in the Honors version, and we had 50 students in the lecture, and in the lab, we actually had two PhDs in lab with us, as well as two graduate students. So I definitely had access. From the first day, those professors learned my names, and I actually have gotten multiple letters of recommendation from them now 5 years later. Also point to some of the upper division courses, because even there, they can be large, have a lot of students, and sometimes the professors teaching 400 level or 500 level courses are the ones who are most deeply engrossed in their research and least willing to contact with the students, but that hasn't been my experience, fortunately. I'll go back to the physical chemistry sequence. I was in it as a student last year. It's chemistry 440, 41, or 42. So a senior level course. It's a requirement for everyone who's in there, and the number is actually 110 students this year. So as the TA, so last year I had contact with, as a student teacher or student professor relationship. Then he invited me to serve as his assistant, and so now I'm not only teaching the students, but I meet with him 3 to 4 times a week. I hold office hours right in his office. So yes, there's definitely contact.
Thank you.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For Ms. Mendoza, thank you very much for your service on the State Board of Higher Education. And reflecting on your comments about the value of education and the valuing of diversity and the increasing diversity on our campuses, I was just struck by the thoughtfulness of your comments and want to encourage you to consider a submission of an In My Opinion piece or a feature piece to the Oregonian. Your comments were just very, very well presented. And again, appreciate your leadership. And I don't know what your future plans are in terms of the political arena, but there's a place for you here.
Come shoot some of my district, so we. That might be a huge move.
It's called the succession plan.
Mr. Greger, have you been admitted to medical school already?
Senator Devlin, I have not. I have not applied, actually. I'm planning to take 1 year off.
Okay.
I'll be taking the MCAT, the entrance exam, in about 4 weeks.
Okay.
And to be honest, I think through the opportunities that I've been given to study abroad, to be in the Honors College, to take a lot of courses that have prepared me well, I'm not incredibly worried about being admitted. I think the system has prepared me well.
Thank you. You have two more students, as I understand. Thank you, Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
Should I stay seated while they come?
Yes, yes. Just bring one up at a time.
One.
Or we can do that.
That'll work.
We're flexible here, so.
All right. Well, for the record, my name is Paul Allen, and I'm a graduate student at the University of Oregon in the mathematics department. This is my fourth year there, and I have to confess, I'd be a lot more comfortable standing up here with the chalkboard giving you a lecture on how to graph equations or something like that. But this morning I'll be telling you about my experiences with teaching at the University of Oregon, and also my experiences with interacting with faculty, in particular how I've been mentored by the faculty members there. I did choose University of Oregon over two other graduate schools. I was accepted at the University of California at Santa Barbara and the University of Colorado at Boulder, primarily because of the teaching. Most graduate students in math, the graduate students do not have the opportunity to teach their own course. And at the University of Oregon, we spend almost all of our terms teaching one course. which is tremendous for me since I want to teach mathematics. And so when I apply for jobs in a year or two, I'll have 5 or 6 years of, I've been teaching my own class for the last 5 or 6 years, and that's great. I teach one class per term. They're at the 100 or 200 level, usually 25 to 35 students in these classes. When I arrived at the University of Oregon, I was given two sets of training on how to teach. One was through the university's teaching effectiveness program, and then one was through the mathematics department, specifically how to teach mathematics. That training was followed up by a weekly seminar I attended for the first term with all the other first-year grad students who were all teaching the same course, and was led by the assistant department head who was also teaching that same course. And we just kind of talk about what's going on this week. We've got natural logs coming up. You know, are you ready for this? How are you going to explain this kind of thing? And they were right there with us. In addition to that, I was observed in the classroom by other graduate students and faculty member, and videotaped by the Teaching Effectiveness Program. And there's nothing scarier than watching a video of yourself teaching math. So until I passed my qualifying exam to qualify as an official PhD-level student, I was limited to teaching essentially Math 111 and 112, which is the college algebra and the elementary functions, kind of a brush-up on let's make sure you're all on the same page before you start calculus. Since I've passed those exams a couple years ago now, I've been teaching calculus classes for a couple years. It's great fun. I love it. I continue to be evaluated each term, both through the standard University of Oregon evaluation form and also through a mathematics department evaluation form, which I find to be the most useful because they're actually written. Students will write comments saying, here's what I liked, here's what I didn't like, some suggestions. The other thing I like about those is not only do I get specifics instead of just, you know, rate this class 1 through 5, but all of those written forms are reviewed by the assistant department head who supervises all of the instruction, and she'll make comments to us about, you know, hey, I noticed this, or I noticed that, and good work, or let's talk about this. And that's kind of a brief summary of teaching. I will tell you a little bit about my research, which is what I spend most of my time doing. I do geometry. That's all you need to know. But when I first arrived at the University of Oregon, I was given two advisors to essentially help me pick up classes that were appropriate for me, folks coming with different levels of background. So you have 500-level classes and then 600-level classes. And I take those classes at the end of the 2 years. I took this qualifying examination, which I alluded to. And that essentially is a big final exam on those 2 years of coursework. After that, I'm officially a PhD student. I chose an advisor. The chair of the Graduate Affairs Committee in the Mathematics Department is great. His name is John Brunden. And so in addition to looking at Peter Gilkey, you should look up John Brunden. I had a class from Peter, by the way. He's a good guy. But he has printed out a list of all the faculty members in our department, what their research interests are, how many students they've had in the past, how many students they have currently, are they interested in another student. And so it's kind of like, here's, you know, where you're at. And it's much better than, say, just trying to run around and, you know, ask, do you know anybody who has an opening? So I chose my advisor, Professor Jim Eisenberg. He will be my primary, or continues to be my primary kind of guide in terms of research. Together, he and I chose a committee of faculty members, three faculty members who are in my area of mathematics, and then one who is not. Later on, when it comes to the thesis defense time, I will add one more member from a different department. And this kind of committee supports my advisor in terms of assisting me with my research. I go to them with help on hard problems. They give me direction. And that's kind of my core group. I meet with my faculty advisor several hours a week. We at least check in twice a day. But, you know, sit down and go through the chalkboard for several hours a week. And that's what I do most of the day. In addition to that, the department kind of keeps me on track. There's always a danger in grad school of kind of being the perpetual student, and, you know, 25 years later, you're still in grad school, and which may be nice for some folks, but our department is particularly good about pushing folks through. Every year, I have to sit down with my advisor and write up a status report of what I've accomplished in the last year, what my current status is, what are my goals for the next year. And so, for example, I'll be taking my oral exam in a month or two. And, you know, if that's not done by the end of the year, they'll say, wait a minute, your report last year said you were going to do that by June. You better have to. The department head also goes around and talks to us personally about how we're doing. I meet with my committee kind of to assess my status and also just talk to other professors. I take advanced courses at the 690 level, and I have professors that are not on my committee and may not even be in my area of research. But if I come across a question, which they happen to be an expert in, I go to them and they sit down and work with me. I also want to point out, I mentioned the John Brennan, the chair of the Graduate Affairs Committee. One of the things he does is kind of, you know, help us get hooked up with his advisors. The other thing that he's done for me is he called me up on the phone the other day and wanted to know if I wanted $500. And I said, yeah. And he'd found a grant that was essentially had my name written on it. And, you know, here, why don't you do this? And I think that's really important. There's a lot of being a professor, which is what I want to be after I get out of grad school, is being able to connect with the greater academic community. And so I'll be going to some conferences this coming summer, one in the Newton Institute in Cambridge, England, and one down at Berkeley, California. We're actually hosting a gravity conference at the end of spring break down at the University of Oregon, which is great. And so having the contacts with my advisor to kind of say, you should go to this and you should check out that, has been really great. I think that's pretty much all I wanted to tell you. So, thanks. We'll open up for questions.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, all right.
Carol.
Good morning, Chair Devlin and Joint Ways and Means Committee on Education. For the record, my name is Adriana Gurr, and I'm a second-year counseling student at the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I feel very honored to be part of this process. I work with a lot of clients who deal with anxiety or panic disorders, and I teach them belly breathing, which is what I've been doing over there in the chair for the last hour and a half. See if it's worked. This summer, I will graduate with my MS in counseling with a focus in community mental health. My time at Portland State has been very rewarding for me. My husband and I moved here to Oregon in the summer of 2003. We arrived on a Friday, and I started graduate school on a Monday. And life has been pretty exciting ever since. A little bit of background about myself. I graduated from the University of Idaho with a BA in International Studies. I also completed a Master's of Arts of International Relations at University of Essex in England. And I worked in the field in my other life in the field of international education, working abroad and in the States, sending students to study overseas or bringing them to study before I returned to the States in 2001. At that time, I had spent a lot of time with students, and I wanted to be able to do more in-depth work with students because I was doing a lot of advising, and I wanted to be able to connect with them more deeply, and thus decided to pursue my professional counseling degree. I found out about Portland State University's counselor education program via a website, and even though being an out-of-state student, I was very drawn to it. I wanted to be part of a nationally accredited program, and Portland State definitely meets that criteria. Only about 30% of the nation's counseling programs are nationally accredited, and Portland State meets that criteria. I've had classes in legal and ethics, adolescent suicide, addictions assessment, multicultural issues, things that will all impact the world in mental health counseling in the community level. Also, what's drawn us into this community is my husband is a chef, and he's also a teacher now at Western Culinary Institute, teaching in the arts. Currently, I'm participating in an internship at Kaiser Permanente, where I work 20 to 24 hours a week, seeing an average of 7 to 10 clients. For individual counseling. Later this month, I will also start co-facilitating group work with a nationally acclaimed group work specialist, Greg Crosby. I'm very excited to have this opportunity. At my internship, I work as a hands-on mental health therapist. I participate in daily consultations, weekly supervision, and I am responsible for my work. I love my placement, and I'm proud to be part of Portland State University Counselor Education Department, and also representing them here. I will continue my internship until mid-August, when I plan to find employment in the field in Portland. Additionally, I also take classes full-time and work as a graduate assistant to Portland State University and work on a small research project at OHSU. My time at Portland State has rewarded me with unique opportunities. Currently, I'm mentored by the Dean of the Graduate School of Education as her graduate assistant. My practicum is based on our campus, where we have a clinic where we've provided counseling, low-cost counseling to members of the Portland community that have little or no insurance. I've been also able to work in counselor education focus groups and work in producing the research highlights publication that highlights the research of graduate school of education. I've also made some great friends and contacts that I plan to cherish long after graduation. My husband and I bought a home in Portland this last year, and we plan to continue to make Portland our home. Our next step is to be fully employed by the end of the year, start paying back student loans, but also apply my skills and give back to the community. And I feel very fortunate and I'm happy to be a newly minted Oregon citizen. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? Well, thank you very much. Thank you both. And
next is Tim Nesbitt, who's also from the State Board of Higher Education.
And thank you, Ms. Mendoza.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I just had a comment. I feel much better that the future is in good hands as long as we're able to maintain our education system.
Thank you.
And I'll step down now.
Pass the paper.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Nesbitt. I'm a member of the State Board of Higher Education, also president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, but here to present to you this morning as co-chair of State Board's Access and Affordability Work Group.
Would you like them to have this single sheet in front of them?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. That would be helpful. But I'm going to
this morning
change the sequence here, if I may. If I could introduce our subject, I would then like to turn over the microphone to Megan Ward, just in case we're running out of time. I can always come back, but it would be more difficult for her to do so, if that's acceptable. We wanted to discuss with you today the nature of enrollment demand for higher education. And with that, I think the flip side is our demand for enrollment. We have set an Oregon benchmark of having 45% of our adult age Oregonians with four-year college degrees by the year 2010. We're only at 30% now. So we actually have a long way to go when we talk about this question of affordability and its connection to access and our ability to educate more students in our post-secondary education system, which involves the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which you heard something of, a lot about, last week when I was here with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. But it also involves how we handle tuition increases, and it also involves the policy question of the use of tuition dollars for scholarships and grants. And that's the so-called fee remissions question. So at this point, I think it makes sense if I may introduce Megan Ward from the University of Oregon, who is a recipient of a presidential scholarship there, which is one of those scholarships which fit under the category of fee remissions. And she'll tell you her story. And then, time permitting, I'll be able to complete the remainder of my presentation. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Megan Ward, and I am from Klamath Falls. And I am currently a proud freshman at the University of Oregon. And before I begin, I would just like to say that I had the pleasure of actually having a class with Paul Allen last term, and he does do a wonderful job at the chalkboard. I'm standing before you today to share my appreciation for the scholarships I have received and to enlighten you with the opportunities that they have allowed me. It seems that just the other day, I was a senior in high school, spending every free second filling out college and scholarship applications. Like most college-bound students, I really was not sure of what my future would bring. Would I get accepted to the schools I applied? Would I financially be able to afford the expenses of tuition? These were questions that I could not ignore. Before spring break, the first question I had been settled, as I had been accepted to several universities that I had applied, including the U of O. However, as far as the financial situation, I had not heard much. I had received a few scholarships to the out-of-state universities that I had applied, but the expense was still too high. At this point, I had not heard back from the U of O, the school that was my number one choice. It wasn't until the last day of spring break when I had returned home after being gone for a week, and about midnight opened an envelope from the U of O. When I read the letter which told me that I had been selected as a recipient of the presidential scholarship, I did not believe it. I had to read the letter over several times before reality set in. From there, I jumped off the couch and went racing upstairs to my parents' bedroom, where they awoke in panic as I was screaming, trying to share the exciting news with them. They were in as much shock as I was, with my grandparents, parents, and oldest brother all being graduates of the U of O. I, too, was going to be a duck. Sure, this offer of the presidential scholarship provided me with making an easy decision for which school to attend, but the opportunity this provided me with will extend long into my future. The presidential scholarship will allow me to graduate from college virtually debt-free, not to mention taking a huge burden off of my parents, who are currently funding my two older brothers' educations as well, one who is a graduate student at the UC Santa Barbara, and the other an undergrad at the University of California Institute of Technology. Talk about a financial burden. This scholarship has also allowed me to concentrate on my studies and pursue extracurricular activities rather than having to balance a part-time job to pay for the expense of school. On a more personal note, the scholarship has allowed me the opportunity to make my childhood dream of becoming a pediatrician a reality. I was born 2.5 months premature and was delivered by cesarean section. Due to complications in delivery, I was born without a heartbeat and I was not breathing. This continued on for 5 minutes while the doctors desperately tried to revive me. Of course, by this point, all the doctors had given up hope. And by chance of some miracle, one doctor was finally able to get my heart to start beating and my lungs to take their first breath. I believe that from that day on, I have always been determined to be that doctor. This might appear as a touching story, which is exactly what it would be, simply just a story, if it were not for the donors of my scholarship who have turned the story into a reality. The Justina Foundation chose to help make my childhood dream possible, and I am living it in full color at the U of O, working towards a major in chemistry for pre-med. I feel very fortunate, for there are many students whose dreams were not answered to, since they were not offered the financial help as I was. I say that every dream should be a possibility, and that the issue of money should never be a hindering barrier. I cannot express my gratitude for the scholarship enough. Hopefully, I will be able to make a difference in someone's life, just as the doctor and the scholarship has done for me. So thank you. Thanks for making a difference in not only my life, but the many other scholars at the University of Oregon. Thank you.
If I may, Senator, I'm going to go back to slide number 36 and go through the rest of my presentation. As you see, OUS enrollment has grown by 19,000 students over the past 10 years. That's the equivalent of a campus the size of OSU. And it's projected to grow by another 11,000 by 2012. Although the rate of enrollment growth has slowed in the past several years, student demand continues to be strong, fueled by the demographics of having more high school graduates in the pipeline and the economics of the recognized necessity of having a bachelor's degree in today's knowledge-based economy. Now, real income growth has occurred in the last several decades only for those with a college degree, and the annual income disparity between those with only a high school diploma and those with a college degree continues to grow. On average, nationally, those with a bachelor's degree earn almost $20,000 a year more than those with only a high school diploma, and those with a master's almost $30,000 a year more, those with a doctorate $50,000 a year more. And for a state like ours, so reliant on income tax revenue for public services, it's of individual and state benefit to increase the educational attainment rates of our citizens. I summarize this for you on the handout where I've added a summary of the highlights from our work group's findings. And actually, the way of posing this problem in the negative is to say that with declining access and with the failure to meet our benchmark goals for higher education, That represents a lost opportunity and lost earning power for individual Oregonians, as well as a failure to maintain the attractiveness of our business climate and our competitiveness in the economy as a state, and in turn, less tax revenue, and in turn, greater social costs. And you can kind of follow the vicious circle that follows. We'd rather turn that into a virtuous circle where we're educating more students, getting better paying jobs in the state, better ability to support the state, the services that our general fund supports, and less demand for safety net services from our citizens. If I may show you how this pipeline looks on a graph, we have both the echo boom, the children of the baby boom generation, who are going to continue to exert influence on our schools and colleges over the remainder of the decade, but also we've had in the 90s an intense in-migration of families who are in turn fueling demand for future enrollment for their own children. And then look at our experience, and I'm sure you've seen this before in other representations, with tuition and fees. Because of our fiscal crisis, the state's been unable to invest in the university system to the extent necessary to ease the financial burden on students. And as you can see on the slide, tuitions have risen as the state investment has declined. While we're able to keep the tuition increase to 10% this year because of a tuition mitigation plan adopted by our board.
Mr. Nesbitt, 10% this biennium, do you mean?
We managed to look at the second year of the biennium.
Oh, okay.
And use savings from the chancellor's office to cap tuition increases that otherwise would have been greater than 10% in the second year.
Okay.
And it's a 21% increase, actually, over the past 2 years for a lot of Oregon students, depending on their institution and the number of credit hours they were taking, which is pretty hard for students and their families to absorb. On the handout that you have, I'd like to make one correction at the top of the page where we say post-secondary education has become less affordable. It's true, as I reported to you when I was here with OSAC last week, that we received an F for affordability in 04 and 02. But we now rank, not 34th, we now rank 46th for affordability. That 34th was 34 among the Fs, unfortunately. It was in, so I want to make sure you're not getting any misinformation. It's 46th among the 50 states in affordability when we look at the 2004 measuring up.
Looks like this.
So, if I can continue with this graph, as the student share of costs grew from 41% to 55% in just two biennia, access has been put at risk as those students who are less able to afford those costs are able to attend our post-secondary institutions. And we would ask the legislature to consider not just the Oregon Opportunity Grant mechanism, but to moderate increases in tuition. In the recommended budget that you have from the governor, there's a recommendation for no more than 5 to 7% in the first year of the next biennium and 5% in the second year, which would help continue to moderate this otherwise escalating trend of tuition increases. And, in fact, would help low- and moderate-income Oregonians be able to continue to afford, even though it's a stretch, at least make things not that much worse for them when it comes to the affordability of post-secondary education. As you see in the next chart, with the cost of college on the rise and our state grant program falling far short of what we need, we're beginning to see a stratification by income in Oregon regarding who can go to college. In 2003-2004, the eligibility cutoff for the Oregon Opportunity Grant was lowered from 75% of median family income to 55%. And this had the effect of shutting out a significant portion of struggling working families in Oregon from receiving the help they need to enable their children to go to college. The recommendation in the budget for a doubling of the Oregon Opportunity Grant to $91.6 million will make post-secondary education obviously more affordable for those students it reaches, and that's where you have the detail again from the handout we provided. And it also will help to offset an unfortunate byproduct of changes at the federal level in the Pell Grant program, where because the way eligibility is calculated, and since one of the changing factors has to do with family income before and after state taxes, state income taxes, we're being affected in a way that we'll probably see about 1,000 fewer Oregon students qualify for federal Pell Grants in the next fiscal year than now qualify. The next chart displays some of the data I shared with you when I was here with OSAC last week, and that is that although we can look at many factors which contribute to the unaffordability of post-secondary education in Oregon, including the fact that we have slightly lower than average family incomes here compared to other states, and we have higher than average tuitions, and that's certainly the case when you do the comparisons among West Coast schools, the biggest factor by far is the fact when it comes to state-financed, need-based financial aid, we're far behind what other states do. And that's why we're so low on the list for affordability nationally. Here you see four measures of comparison. When you look at Oregon's commitment via the Oregon Opportunity Grant to need-based financial aid, it averages $133 per year per enrolled undergraduate student. Now, obviously, that includes many more students than receive the grant, but that's one measure of effort. If we take the same measure and apply it to all states nationally, we see $354 per student. Our neighbor to the south, California, $367, and in Washington State, which has been frequently cited in recent press reports about how well they do versus how much catching up we have to do, $483 per student. Now, you also see a little side note in the box there, if you can read it. Families in Oregon in the lower income quintiles must use such a large part of their family income to support their students going to college that it really acts as a deterrent to even enrolling. The lowest income Oregon students use the equivalent, and that's the bottom 20%, the equivalent of 69% of family income to pay for college after receiving financial aid. And nationally, that number was 25% of family income.
Mr. Nesbitt, where are you at in your presentation? I would be more than willing to have you start tomorrow, or would you want to close off? I don't want to rush you, actually.
I wanted to cover, Senator, there are three more slides, and I wanted to cover fee remissions and tuition. But that, I have a feeling you're going
to
have more questions for me.
I think it might be better to do that tomorrow morning, because I would like the committee to spend a little bit of time on this, because this issue is going to be a significant issue during Phase 2 and Phase 3 of our deliberations, because although there are many people that are supportive of the governor's recommendation on opportunity grants, it's going to be a change in policy, and as such, it's probably going to receive a lot more discussion in this committee than some of the other items in the OUS budget. Can you come back tomorrow morning to start?
Right at 8:30 I can, Senator. I'd appreciate that.
And we will start promptly right at 8:30. Can I ask for the future, not tomorrow, I don't expect immediate turnaround. California is practically a nation unto itself, so I'm not going to, and I don't want to, but Washington is approximately probably a couple million more people than Oregon, probably double the economy of Oregon, but could we get in the future some sort of two- or three-page statement on what sort of need-based aid that Washington has and how they fund it and what the history of that has been? Because I think that might be beneficial to the committee. Are there any questions for the good of the order now? If there are none, I wanted to thank Ms. Ward for her excellent presentation and everyone else who's presented today. We are almost exactly on schedule, but we will return to our normal pattern tomorrow and try to stay on schedule. But, Mr. Nesbitt, I'll see you at 8:30, and we will start promptly at 8:30. With that, I will close this meeting today for today, and we will be back tomorrow morning.
Very good.